TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Real History. The Myth of the Founding Fathers. This is part one of a four-part series on real history by the noted scholar and author Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is among our leading progressive political analysts. He received his PhD in political science from Yale in 1962 and has taught at colleges in the U.S. and abroad. The focus of his lectures is American democracy, U.S. foreign policy, and the invented reality of the media. As the United States government claims to spread democracy around the world and is deeply involved in ghostwriting constitutions for other countries, the spotlight falls back on this country. Is the current U.S. system a democracy? Has it ever been one? In the myth of the Founding Fathers, Michael Parenti takes us back to the early days of the Republic. Who were the Founding Fathers? What were their goals in writing the U.S. Constitution? Who did they exclude, and who did they favor? What was their attitude toward slavery? How many of them actually wanted to create a monarchy? And who, in the end, ratified the Constitution after it was written? Here is Michael Parenti with answers to these questions in part one of the lecture series on history, The Myth of the Founding Fathers.
As we were taught in school, a group of dedicated leaders of our young nation, called our Founding Fathers, met in Philadelphia in 1787 to build a nation and to write a constitution. The United States of that time has been described as an egalitarian society. It was supposedly free from the extremes of want and wealth that characterized the feudal old world. But in fact, there were landed estates and there were colonial mansions that were really quite impressive and demonstrated a most impressive accumulation of wealth. From the earliest English settlements, men of influence received vast land grants from the British Crown. By 1700, three-fourths of the acreage in New York State belonged to fewer than a dozen persons. By 1760, fewer than 500 men in five colonial cities controlled most of the commerce, the banking, the mining, the manufacturing, and most of the newspapers and journals on the eastern seaboard, and they owned most of the land. This was hardly your egalitarian middle-class society. As of 1787, property qualifications left perhaps more than a third of the white male population disfranchised. Property qualifications for holding office were so steep that most voters could not even qualify as candidates. Thus, a member of the New Jersey legislature had to be worth about £1,000 free of debt even to run for office. There also were no secret ballots. The men who got together in Philadelphia to frame the Constitution were financially successful planters, slaveholders, merchants, creditors, bankers, and manufacturers. Who else can take 4.5 months off to go sit in Philadelphia and write a constitution? Many of them were linked to each other by kinship and marriage, and by years of service in Congress or the military or diplomatic service. And they had three things they wanted to do. They wanted to build a stronger central government to deal better with the conditions of trade and industry within the 13 states. They also wanted to build a stronger central government to deal better with other nations. But there was a third reason. It's the one that the historians who don't want to bother with real history never talk about. The framers of the Constitution were very troubled with the increasingly insurgent spirit, rebellious spirit, among the common population. There were attempts to take over state governments, there was broad agitation, and the wealthy class looked to a national government as a means of protecting their interests, as a means of building a stronger mechanism of national control. Most historians say very little about the actual plight of the common people in that time. Most of the agrarian population, and about 85% of Americans in 1787 lived in the agrarian sector. Most of them consisted of small farmers, tenants, or indentured servants. Indentured servants were white people who were in indenture, that is, they were in conditions of servitude. It wasn't quite slavery because it was for a fixed time and they could get out eventually. They could work their way out. These people were burdened by heavy rents, ruinous taxes, and low incomes. To survive, they frequently had to borrow money at very high interest rates. To pay their debts, they mortgaged their future crops. When you mortgage your future crop, you go still deeper into debt. So large numbers of them were caught in that cycle of rural indebtedness, which is today still the common fate of many agrarian peoples in many countries who are in the grip of the moneyed interests. Throughout this period, by the way, newspapers complained of, quote, increasing numbers of young beggars in the streets. Economic prisoners crowded the jails. Many were incarcerated for debts or non-payment of taxes. And among the American people, there grew the feeling that the revolution against the English crown had been fought for no good reason. Disorders of a violent but organized kind occurred in a number of states. In the winter of 1787, the most dramatic disorder was when debtor farmers in western Massachusetts, led by Daniel Shays, took up arms. But their rebellion was crushed by the state militia after several skirmishes that left exactly 11 men dead and scores wounded. When the founding fathers, so-called founding fathers, met in Philadelphia, they were determined that persons of birth and fortune and affluence should control the affairs of the nation and check the what they call the leveling impulses of the propertyless multitude that composed the what Madison called a majority faction. James Madison, who played probably the most crucial role in the Constitution, putting the Constitution together, talked about how it was important in his famous Federalist Paper number 10, how it was important to keep the spirit and form of popular government with only a minimum of the substance. How do you construct a government? This was the task, he said, that the framers were facing. How do you construct a government that would win some popular support but would not tamper with the existing class structure? A government strong enough to service the growing needs of an entrepreneurial class while withstanding the democratic egalitarian demands of the popular class. And the way you do it is by excluding the popular class from most of the crucial points of power. The framers all agreed with Madison when he wrote in his Federalist Number 10 that, quote, the most common and durable source of faction, and by faction he meant class whenever he used the word faction, the most common and durable source of faction has been the various and unequal distribution of property. Those who hold and those who are without property have ever formed distinct interests in society. Now, if you say that today, you're called a Marxist. Well, Madison was talking about reality, and we can't help it if certain forms of reality are Marxist. The first object of government, Madison went on, is the protection of different and unequal faculties for acquiring property. Elbridge Gerry, another one of the framers in Philadelphia, noted that democracy was the worst of all political evils. Both he and Madison warned of the danger of the leveling spirit. Roger Sherman of Connecticut, another delegate to Philadelphia, the people should have as little to do as may be about the government. Alexander Hamilton, of course, all communities divide themselves into the few and the many. The first are the rich and the well-born. The other are the mass of the people. And the people are turbulent and changing. They seldom judge or determine right. So these delegates were rather explicit that the further you could keep people from government, the better. Now, they spent many weeks debating their interests, and most of the historical accounts about the founding fathers is about these differences, the differences between merchants and slave owners and manufacturers, the debate between the Northerners and the Southerners. But this was a debate of haves versus haves, in which each group sought to safeguard its own interests. And it involved mostly questions of representation and structure. On these issues, there were no dirt farmers or poor artisans attending the convention to offer an opposing view. They couldn't take 4 months off to go to Philadelphia. And for the most part, the framers built a constitution that would have the power to support commerce and protect the interests of property in a variety of ways. Lay and collect taxes, establish a national currency, fix imports and duties, set up uniform laws on bankruptcy, pay the debts, and so forth. Some of the delegates, for instance, were land speculators, and they expressed a real concern about Western holdings and dealing with the Indian tribes. And so Congress was given the, quote, the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. That's right from our Constitution. In other words, to deal with the territories and the Indians. Some delegates were speculated very highly in inflated and nearly worthless securities that had been floated under the Articles of Confederation. Well, under Article 6, all debts that had been incurred under the Confederation were now valid against the new government, and this allowed speculators to make enormous profits because they bought these securities, for a pittance, and now they were being refunded and honored at face value. So they made quite a killing for themselves. In the interests of these merchants and creditors, the states were prohibited from issuing paper money or imposing duties on imports and exports or interfering with the payment of debts. There was another form of property that was mentioned in the Constitution, a very important one, and it was afforded a special accommodation, slavery, the property of other human beings. They were never called slaves. They would say persons in bondage and bondage and such, and persons in servitude. The importation of slaves, they were never called slaves in the Constitution, but that's what they were. The importation of slaves was given constitutional protection for about 20 years, another 20 years. Slaves who escaped from one state to another had to be delivered up to the original owner upon claim. This was a provision that was unanimously adopted in the convention. The framers were also worried about rebellions by workers and such. And would the state militias prove reliable as the working class grew in numbers? And by the way, they anticipated a day when the mass of the people would be working, not on their own land, but working as employees. Well, Congress was given the task of, quote, organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia and calling it forth to suppress insurrections. Those are quotes right from the Constitution. And by the way, that was a provision that was to prove a godsend for the industrial barons a century later in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s, when the army was used repeatedly to break strikes by miners and railroad workers and factory workers. The method of representation was interesting. Nobody could vote for the president. The chief executive was to be selected by an electoral college that was voted by the people. But the framers anticipated that these meetings of the Electoral College, each in the various states, would consist of political leaders and men of substance, again, who would be able to travel to the state capital and sit there and debate who should be president. They'd gather in their various states, and they would choose a president of their own liking. So the Electoral College was set up as a kind of filter against popular sentiment. The Senate could not be elected. The Senate was picked by the state legislatures rather than directly elected by the people. Senators were not elected by the people until the 20th century. The Supreme Court, which could have final say over the constitutionality of laws, was elected by no one. Its justices were appointed to life tenure by the president and confirmed by the Senate. So you had a very elaborate structure up there that was far removed from the popular will. The only portion of government that was directly elected by the people was the House of Representatives, and even that took something of an argument to get through. It took a number of people. The delegates finally agreed to having the people elect the lower house. But when they talked about the people, by the way, when they talked about the people, they were referring to a select portion of the population. As I said, property qualifications disfranchised the poorest white males in various states. There were all sorts of other ways of disfranchising would-be voters. Literacy tests, inaccessibility of voting. You'd have to go 10, 15 miles on a horse and wagon to get to the county seat to vote. You were not likely to vote over those muddy roads and whatever else. Half of the adult population was denied suffrage because they were women. American Indians had no access to the ballot. About one-fourth of both men and women had no vote because they were held in bondage. And even the African Americans who had gained their legal freedom, the black people who had gained their freedom in both the North and the South, which was a small portion, but none was allowed to vote until the passage of the 14th Amendment. Well, the question comes up, well, were these framers of the Constitution motivated by financial interests of their own, simply, or by a national interest? This has been debated ever since Charles Beard published a very great book, which I recommend to you, An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution, which he published in 1913. The defenders of our, quote, founding fathers said they weren't guided by their class interests. They were concerned with higher things, things other than just lining their purses. They were motivated by a concern for nation building that went beyond their particular class interests. The argument so goes. Well, I think to presume that there's a dichotomy between the desire to build a strong nation and the desire to protect wealth, that's a fallacy. And the other fallacy is to presume that the framers could not have been motivated by both. In fact, like most people, they believed that what was good for them was ultimately good for the entire society. Their universal values and their class values went hand in hand. And to discover the existence of a higher sentiment, that they wanted a strong central government, a strong nation, doesn't eliminate the self-interested one. I mean, just as many of these same framers could say and sincerely feel that they were dedicated to the principle of liberty for all and at the same time own slaves, so they could serve both their nation and their estates. The point is not that they were devoid of a grander sentiment of nation building, but that there was nothing in their concept of nation that worked against their class interests. And there was a great deal in their concept of nation, including a strong central government, a government with checks and balances, and a government that was removed from popular will, a great deal in their concept of a national government that worked for their class interests. It was to filter out the popular will and to thwart or blunt the leveling impulses of the people. Those historians who argue that the founders were motivated primarily by high-minded objectives consistently overlook the fact that the founders themselves repeatedly stated their intentions to erect a government strong enough to protect the haves from the have-nots. I mean, they said that explicitly. They gave voice to the crassest class prejudices. I just quoted you a few examples. They talked about how the people were unreliable, the people couldn't judge, and all that sort of thing. Their concern was to diminish popular control and resist all tendencies toward class equalization or class justice, or what they called in that day leveling. Their opposition and their distrust of democracy, and by democracy they meant what Plato and Aristotle meant by democracy and what I mean by democracy, they meant a system not just of elections but a system that served the interests of the demos, of the mass of the people. Their opposition to democracy and their dedication to moneyed interests was openly and repeatedly avowed. In fact, their preoccupation with their class interests was so pronounced that one of the delegates, James Wilson of Pennsylvania, finally complained that he was hearing too much about how the sole or primary object of government was property and defending property and protecting property. The cultivation and improvement of the human mind, Wilson maintained, was the most notable object. And this was a very fine sentiment, and it evoked no opposition from his colleagues, and they continued to go about their business. As for democracy, let me point out that when Colonel Mason of Virginia got up toward the end of the convention, and he said, "This Constitution needs a Bill of Rights," that proposal was voted down unanimously, without debate, with just the delegation from Massachusetts abstaining. So the Constitution was a rather undemocratic instrument. Well, if it was so blatantly elitist, how did it manage to win ratification? How did it win the popular vote? Well, in fact, the Constitution was never submitted to a popular vote. It was never ratified by the people. It was ratified in state conventions, and those conventions were controlled by generally men of substance or whatever else. And having said all this, let me add, though, that the Constitution was not without some real democratic concessions for its time. For instance, there was no property qualifications for federal office. Salaries were going to be paid to officials. This eliminated then the practice of public office being open only to the rich who could afford it. The president and all office holders were elected for limited terms. No one could claim a life tenure on any office except the Supreme Court justices and the other federal judges. There was no religious test required for qualification. That was a progressive and democratic step forward. By the way, that was a feature that's very different from in a number of state constitutions. There were explicit bans against Catholics, Jews, and non-believers from holding office. There were bills of attainder were outlawed, that is, you can't find someone guilty of an offense without benefit of a trial. And then eventually, the Congress was forced to pass the first 10 amendments. In fact, the only way they could guarantee getting the Constitution ratified, a number of states said, we'll ratify it only if you pledge to put in a Bill of Rights. And that Bill of Rights had a whole bunch of excellent democratic things like freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom to assemble, freedom to peaceably petition for redress of grievances, a separation of church and state. The Constitution also did something else. It guaranteed a republican form of government. Article 1, Section 9, no title of nobility shall be granted by the Constitution. In other words, it said this is an open system and all that, but you cannot go back to monarchy or aristocracy, which was a real concession because about 21 of the 55 delegates favored some form of monarchy. They couldn't come out and say it because of popular opposition, but about 21, almost half of the delegates would have, if they had their way, and they would have had a king. So these men feared and loathed democracy, and yet on a number of occasions they found it necessary to show some regard for popular sentiment, as with the direct election of the lower house, as with putting in a republican form of government, and so forth. They understood that if the Constitution was going to be accepted by the states, and if it was going to have any stability, it had to gain some measure of popular acceptance. So they felt compelled to leave something for the people. So they were powerful. They dominated the events of 1787 to 1789, but they were far from omnipotent. The class system they sought to preserve was itself the cause of marked restlessness among the people, and this was the contradiction they're constantly dealing with. There still continued to be land seizures by the poor, food riots, and other violent disturbances throughout the 18th century. This popular ferment, by the way, spurred the framers in their effort to erect a strong central government, but it also set a limit on what they could do. They didn't give us a Bill of Rights. They didn't give us these democratic things. These were won by the agitation of democratic forces in the society. These were concessions, including the Bill of Rights, which they reluctantly, just reluctantly, gave up. They had to make concessions, just the way management today reluctantly gives certain concessions or a contract to its workers because that's what they've got to do because the workers are well organized enough, and this is the only way to get them back to work. So it was under the threat of democratic rebellion that they made these democratic concessions. They kept what they could, and they grudgingly relinquished what they felt they had to. And what I'm saying, the myth of the founding fathers, is that they were driven not by a love of democracy, but by a fear of it. Not by a love of the people, but by a prudent desire to avoid popular uprisings. The Constitution, then, was a product not only of class privilege, but of class struggle, a struggle that continues to this day.
That was Michael Parenti with part one of a four-part series on history, The Myth of the Founding Fathers. Come back for the next program on TUC Radio when Parenti will discuss the Spanish-American War and the rise of U.S. imperialism. Here's a brief preview from that lecture.
The Spanish-American War was fought between the U.S. and Spain in 1898. Now, well before that war, American business interests had been growing overseas and enjoying the protection of the U.S. Navy and Marines. But the war does mark a turning point in that process. That is a turning point in the use of American military power to ensure economic expansion. In 1898, Cuba was still a Spanish colony. And by the way, there already was a war underway. It had been going on for years. It was a war between the Cuban insurgents, the Cuban National Liberation Forces, against the Spanish colonial army. Well, why did the U.S. intervene in Cuba by sending the battleship Maine down there and doing a bunch of other things? Supposedly, the Maine's visit was just a friendly visit, and supposedly McKinley was concerned about protecting American interests in Cuba. But what were American interests in Cuba? Supposedly, Washington was at odds with Madrid because Spain was acting in a repressive way in Cuba. Indeed, Spain was acting in a repressive way. Concentration camps, mass arrests, killing people, trying to repress the insurgency. In addition, the rebellion in Cuba was said to be jeopardizing not only American lives and property on the island, but also the national security of the United States itself. And what Spain was doing to the poor Cubans was a violation of the sentiments of humanity. Well, these denunciations of Spanish cruelties, and there were plenty of Spanish cruelties, they increased in frequency as the U.S. decided it wanted to take over Spain's colonies. The U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1898 reported, quote, "The duplicity, perfidy, and cruelty of the Spanish character. This is something the Spaniards have always been and still continue to be in Cuba." Secretary of War Russell Hagel talked about the inhuman cruelties and the absolute barbarity of perpetrated by the Spaniards against the Cuban people. Well, a closer reading of history reveals that the U.S. leaders were more interested in national gain than in humanitarian rescue. That is, they were more interested in Cuba than in the Cubans.
Michael Parenti on the Spanish-American War, coming up on the next program. Michael Parenti is an internationally known author and lecturer. He's one of the nation's leading progressive political thinkers and has taught at colleges in the U.S. and abroad. His books include Democracy for the Few, Super Patriotism, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, The Terrorism Trap, and History as Mystery. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. You can get information on how to order an audio CD by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654. For information on how to order, you can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. The brief moment in which a pilot may save the plane.
My name is Maria Gelodin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.